Thus, his policies appeared to have ended in disaster, but in fact they were pursued with more moderation by his successors. A compromise favourable to the papacy was patched up for the moment, but the conflict was essentially irreconcilable. Its later stages will be dealt with in a subsequent chapter. It remains to say something of the intellectual revival in the 11th century. The 10th century was destitute of philosophers, except for Gerbert, Pope Sylvester II, 999 to 1003, and even he was more a mathematician than a philosopher. But as the 11th century advanced, men of real philosophical eminence began to appear. Of these, the most important were Anselm and Rousselin, but some others deserve mention. All were monks connected with the Reform movement. Peter Damian, the oldest of them, has already been mentioned. Berengar of Tours, died 1088, is interesting as being something of a rationalist. He maintained that reason is superior to authority, in support of which view he appealed to John the Scot, who was therefore posthumously condemned. Berengar denied transubstantiation and was twice compelled to recant. His heresies were combated by Lanfranc in his book, De Corpore et Sanguine Domini. Lanfranc was born at Pavia, studied law at Bologna, and became a first-rate dialectician. But he abandoned dialectic for theology and entered the monastery of Bec in Normandy, where he conducted a school. William the Conqueror made him Archbishop of Canterbury in 1070. St. Anselm was, like Lanfranc, an Italian, a monk at Bec and Archbishop of Canterbury, 1093 to 1109. In which capacity he followed the principles of Gregory VII and quarrelled with the king. He is chiefly known to fame as the inventor of the ontological argument for the existence of God. As he put it, the argument is as follows. We define God as the greatest possible object of thought. Now, if an object of thought does not exist, another, exactly like it, which does exist, is greater. Therefore, the greatest of all objects of thought must exist, since otherwise another still greater would be possible. Therefore, God exists. This argument has never been accepted by theologians. It was adversely criticized at the time, then it was forgotten till the latter half of the 13th century. Thomas Aquinas rejected it, and among theologians his authority has prevailed ever since. But among philosophers it has had a better fate. Descartes revived it in a somewhat amended form. Leibniz thought that it could be made valid by the addition of a supplement to prove that God is possible. Kant considered that he had demolished it once for all. Nevertheless, in some sense, it underlies the system of Hegel and his followers, and reappears in Bradley's principle, what may be and must be is. Clearly, an argument with such a distinguished history is to be treated with respect, whether valid or not. The real question is there anything we can think of which, by the mere fact that we can think of it, is shown to exist outside our thought? Every philosopher would like to say yes, because a philosopher's job is to find out things about the world by thinking rather than observing. If yes is the right answer, there is a bridge from pure thought to things. If not, not. In this generalized form, Plato uses a kind of ontological argument to prove the objective reality of ideas. But no one before Anselm had stated the argument in its naked logical purity. In gaining purity, it loses plausibility, but this also is to Anselm's credit. For the rest, Anselm's philosophy is mainly derived from St. Augustine, from whom it acquires many Platonic elements. He believes in Platonic ideas, from which he derives another proof of the existence of God. By Neoplatonic arguments, he professes to prove not only God, but the Trinity. It will be remembered that Plotinus has a Trinity, though not one that a Christian can accept as orthodox. Anselm considers reason subordinate to faith. I believe in order to understand, he says. Following Augustine, he holds that without belief it is impossible to understand. God, he says, is not just, but justice. It will be remembered that John the Scot says similar things. The common origin is in Plato. St. Anselm, like his predecessors in Christian philosophy, is in the Platonic rather than the Aristotelian tradition. For this reason, he has not the distinctive characteristics of the philosophy which is called scholastic, which culminated in Thomas Aquinas. This kind of philosophy may be reckoned as beginning with Roscelin, who was Anselm's contemporary, being 17 years younger than Anselm. Roscelin marks a new beginning and will be considered in the next chapter. When it is said that medieval philosophy, until the 13th century, was mainly Platonic, it must be remembered that Plato, except for a fragment of the Timaeus, was known only at second or third hand. John the Scot, for example, could not have held the views which he did hold but for Plato. But most of what is Platonic in him comes from the Pseudo-Dionysius. The date of this author is uncertain, but it seems probable that he was a disciple of Proclus, the Neoplatonist. It is probable also that John the Scot had never heard of Proclus or read a line of Plotinus. Apart from the Pseudo-Dionysius, the other source of Platonism in the Middle Ages was Boethius. This Platonism was in many ways different from that which a modern student derives from Plato's own writings. It omitted almost everything that had no obvious bearing on religion, and in religious philosophy it enlarged and emphasized certain aspects at the expense of others. This change in the conception of Plato had already been effected by Plotinus. The knowledge of Aristotle was also fragmentary, but in an opposite direction. All that was known of him until the 12th century was Boethius's translation of The Categories and De Emendatione. Thus, Aristotle was conceived as a mere dialectician, and Plato as only a religious philosopher and the author of the theory of ideas. During the course of the later Middle Ages, both these partial conceptions were gradually amended, especially the conception of Aristotle. But the process, as regards Plato, was not completed until the Renaissance. Chapter 10. Mohammedan Culture and Philosophy. The attacks upon the Eastern Empire, Africa and Spain, differed from those of northern barbarians on the West in two respects. First, the Eastern Empire survived till 1453, nearly 1,000 years longer than the Western. Second, the main attacks upon the Eastern Empire were made by Mohammedans, who did not become Christians after conquest, but developed an important civilization of their own. The Hegira, with which the Mohammedan era begins, took place in AD 622. Footnote: the Hegira was Muhammad's flight from Mecca to Medina. End of footnote. Muhammad died 10 years later. Immediately after his death, the Arab conquests began, and they proceeded with extraordinary rapidity. In the east, Syria was invaded in 634 and completely subdued within 2 years. In 637, Persia was invaded. In 650, its conquest was completed. India was invaded in 664. Constantinople was besieged in 669 and again in 716-17. The westward movement was not quite so sudden. Egypt was conquered by 642, Carthage not till 697. Spain, except for a small corner in the northwest, was acquired in 711-12. Westward expansion, except in Sicily and southern Italy, was brought to a standstill by the defeat of the Mohammedans at the Battle of Tours in 732, just 100 years after the death of the Prophet. The Ottoman Turks, who finally conquered Constantinople, belong to a later period than that with which we are now concerned. Various circumstances facilitated this expansion. Persia and the Eastern Empire were exhausted by their long wars. The Syrians, who were largely Nestorian, suffered persecution at the hands of the Catholics, whereas Mohammedans tolerated all sects of Christians in return for the payment of tribute. Similarly, in Egypt, the Monophysites, who were the bulk of the population, welcomed the invaders. In Africa, the Arabs allied themselves with the Berbers, whom the Romans had never thoroughly subdued. Arabs and Berbers together invaded Spain, where they were helped by the Jews, whom the Visigoths had severely persecuted. The religion of the Prophet was a simple monotheism, uncomplicated by the elaborate theology of the Trinity and the Incarnation. The Prophet made no claim to be divine, nor did his followers make such a claim on his behalf. He revived the Jewish prohibition of graven images and forbade the use of wine. It was the duty of the faithful to conquer as much of the world as possible for Islam. But there was to be no persecution of Christians, Jews, or Zoroastrians, the people of the book, as the Quran calls them, that is, those who followed the teaching of a scripture. Arabia was largely desert and was growing less and less capable of supporting its population. The first conquests of the Arabs began as mere raids for plunder and only turned into permanent occupation after experience had shown the weakness of the enemy. Suddenly, in the course of some 20 years, men accustomed to all the hardships of a meager existence on the fringe of the desert found themselves masters of some of the richest regions of the world, able to enjoy every luxury and to acquire all the refinements of an ancient civilization. They withstood the temptations of this transformation better than most of the northern barbarians had done. As they had acquired their empire without much severe fighting, there had been little destruction, and the civil administration was kept on almost unchanged. Both in Persia and in the Byzantine Empire, the civil government had been highly organized. The Arab tribesmen at first understood nothing of its complications and perforce accepted the services of the trained men whom they found in charge. These men, for the most part, showed no reluctance to serve under their new masters. Indeed, the change made their work easier, since taxation was lightened very considerably. The populations, moreover, in order to escape the tribute, very largely abandoned Christianity for Islam. The Arab Empire was an absolute monarchy under the Caliph, who was the successor of the Prophet and inherited much of his holiness. The Caliphate was nominally elective, but soon became hereditary. The first dynasty, that of the Umayyads, which lasted till 750, was founded by men whose acceptance of Muhammad was purely political, and it remained always opposed to the more fanatical among the faithful. The Arabs, although they conquered a great part of the world in the name of a new religion, were not a very religious race. The motive of their conquests was plunder and wealth, rather than religion. It was only in virtue of their lack of fanaticism that a handful of warriors were able to govern, without much difficulty, vast populations of higher civilization and alien religion. The Persians, on the contrary, have been, from the earliest times, deeply religious and highly speculative. After their conversion, they made out of Islam something much more interesting, more religious and more philosophical than had been imagined by the Prophet and his kinsmen. Ever since the death of Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali, in 661, Muhammadans have been divided into two sects, the Sunni and the Shia. The former is the larger, the latter follows Ali and considers the Umayyad dynasty to have been usurpers. The Persians have always belonged to the Shia sect. Largely by Persian influence, the Umayyads were at last overthrown and succeeded by the Abbasids, who represented Persian interests. The change was marked by the removal of the capital from Damascus to Baghdad. The Abbasids were politically more in favor of the fanatics than the Umayyads had been. They did not, however, acquire the whole of the empire. One member of the Umayyad family escaped the general massacre, fled to Spain, and was there acknowledged as the legitimate ruler. From that time on, Spain was independent of the rest of the Mohammedan world. Under the early Abbasids, the Caliphate attained its greatest splendor. The best known of them is Harun al-Rashid, died 809, who was a contemporary of Charlemagne and the Empress Irene, and is known to everyone in legendary form through the Arabian Nights. His court was a brilliant center of luxury, poetry, and learning. His revenue was enormous. His empire stretched from the Straits of Gibraltar to the Indus. His will was absolute. He was habitually accompanied by the executioner, who performed his office at a nod from the caliph. This splendor, however, was short-lived. His successor made the mistake of composing his army mainly of Turks, who were insubordinate, and soon reduced the caliph to a cipher to be blinded or murdered whenever the soldiery grew tired of him. Nevertheless, the caliphate lingered on. The last caliph of the Abbasid dynasty was put to death by the Mongols in 1256, along with 800,000 of the inhabitants of Baghdad. The political and social system of the Arabs had defects similar to those of the Roman Empire, together with some others. Absolute monarchy combined with polygamy led, as it usually does, to dynastic wars whenever a ruler died, ending with the victory of one of the ruler's sons and the death of all the rest. There were immense numbers of slaves, largely as a result of successful wars. At times there were dangerous servile insurrections. Commerce was greatly developed, the more so as the caliphate occupied a central position between east and west. Not only did the possession of enormous wealth create a demand for costly articles, such as silks from China and furs from Northern Europe, but trade was promoted by certain special conditions, such as the vast extent of the Muslim Empire, the spread of Arabic as a world language, and the exalted status assigned to the merchant in the Muslim system of ethics. It was remembered that the Prophet himself had been a merchant and had commended trading during the pilgrimage to Mecca. This commerce, like military cohesion, depended on the great roads which the Arabs inherited from Romans and Persians, and which they, unlike the northern conquerors, did not allow to fall into disrepair. Gradually, however, the empire broke up into fractions. Spain, Persia, North Africa, and Egypt successively split off and acquired complete or almost complete independence. One of the best features of the Arab economy was agriculture, particularly the skillful use of irrigation, which they learned from living where water is scarce. To this day, Spanish agriculture profits by Arab irrigation works. The distinctive culture of the Muslim world, though it began in Syria, soon came to flourish most in the eastern and western extremities, Persia and Spain. The Syrians, at the time of the conquest, were admirers of Aristotle, whom Nestorians preferred to Plato, the philosopher favored by Catholics. The Arabs first acquired their knowledge of Greek philosophy from the Syrians, and thus, from the beginning, they thought Aristotle more important than Plato. Nevertheless, their Aristotle wore a Neoplatonic dress. Kindi, died circa 873, the first to write philosophy in Arabic, and the only philosopher of note who was himself an Arab, translated parts of the Enneads of Plotinus and published his translation under the title The Theology of Aristotle. This introduced great confusion into Arabic ideas of Aristotle, from which it took Arabic philosophy centuries to recover. Meanwhile, in Persia, Muslims came in contact with India. It was from Sanskrit writings that they acquired, during the 8th century, their first knowledge of astronomy. About 830, Muhammad ibn Musa al-Khwarazmi, a translator of mathematical and astronomical books from the Sanskrit, published a book which was translated into Latin in the 12th century, under the title Algorithmi de Numero Indorum. It was from this book that the West first learnt of what we call Arabic numerals, which ought to be called Indian. The same author wrote a book on algebra, which was used in the West as a textbook until the 16th century. Persian civilization remained both intellectually and artistically admirable until the invasion of the Mongols in the 13th century, from which it never recovered. Omar Khayyam, the only man known to me who was both a poet and a mathematician, reformed the calendar in 1079. His best friend, oddly enough, was the founder of the sect of the Assassins, the Old Man of the Mountain of legendary fame. The Persians were great poets. Firdusi, circa 941, author of the Shahnameh, is said by those who have read him to be the equal of Homer. They were also remarkable as mystics, which other Mohammedans were not. The Sufi sect, which still exists, allowed itself great latitude in the mystical and allegorical interpretation of orthodox dogma. It was more or less Neoplatonic. The Nestorians, through whom at first Greek influences came into the Muslim world, were by no means purely Greek in their outlook. Their school at Edessa had been closed by the Emperor Zeno in 481. Its learned men thereupon migrated to Persia, where they continued their work, but not without suffering Persian influences. The Nestorians valued Aristotle only for his logic, and it was above all his logic that the Arabic philosophers thought important at first. Later, however, they studied also his metaphysics and his De Anima. Arabic philosophers in general are encyclopedic. They are interested in alchemy, astrology, astronomy, and zoology as much as in what we should call philosophy. They were looked upon with suspicion by the populace, which was fanatical and bigoted. They owed their safety, when they were safe, to the protection of comparatively free-thinking princes. Two Mohammedan philosophers, one of Persia, one of Spain, demand special notice. They are Avicenna and Averroes. Of these, the former is the more famous among Mohammedans, the latter among Christians. Avicenna, Ibn Sina, 980 to 1037, spent his life in the sort of places that one used to think only exist in poetry. He was born in the province of Bokhara. At the age of 24, he went to Khiva, Lone Kiva in the waste, then to Khorasan, the lone Khorasmian shore. For a while he taught medicine and philosophy at Isfahan. Then he settled in Tehran. He was even more famous in medicine than in philosophy, though he added little to Galen. From the 12th to the 17th century, he was used in Europe as a guide to medicine. He was not a saintly character. In fact, he had a passion for wine and women. He was suspect to the orthodox, but was befriended by princes on account of his medical skill. At times he got into trouble owing to the hostility of Turkish mercenaries. Sometimes he was in hiding, sometimes in prison. He was the author of an encyclopedia, almost unknown to the East because of the hostility of theologians, but influential in the West through Latin translations. His psychology has an empirical tendency. His philosophy is nearer to Aristotle and less Neoplatonic than that of his Muslim predecessors. Like the Christian scholastics later, he is occupied with the problem of universals. Plato said they were anterior to things. Aristotle has two views, one when he is thinking, the other when he is combating Plato. This makes him ideal material for the commentator. Avicenna invented a formula, which was repeated by Averroes and Albertus Magnus. Thought brings about the generality in forms. From this it might be supposed that he did not believe in universals apart from thought. This, however, would be an unduly simple view. Genera, that is, universals, are, he says, at once before things, in things, and after things. He explains this as follows. They are before things in God's understanding. God decides, for instance, to create cats. This requires that he should have the idea cat, which is thus, in this respect, anterior to particular cats. Genera are in things in natural objects. When cats have been created, felinity is in each of them. Genera are after things in our thought. When we have seen many cats, we notice their likeness to each other and arrive at the general idea cat. This view is obviously intended to reconcile different theories. Averroes, Ibn Rushd, 1126 to 1198, lived at the opposite end of the Muslim world from Avicenna. He was born at Cordova, where his father and grandfather had been Qadis. He himself was a Qadi, first in Seville, then in Cordova. He studied first theology and jurisprudence, then medicine, mathematics, and philosophy. He was recommended to the Caliph, Abu Yaqub Yusuf, as a man capable of making an analysis of the works of Aristotle. It seems, however, that he did not know Greek. This ruler took him into favor. In 1184, he made him his physician, but unfortunately the patient died 2 years later. His successor, Yaqub al-Mansur, for 11 years continued his father's patronage. Then, alarmed by the opposition of the orthodox to the philosopher, he deprived him of his position and exiled him, first to a small place near Cordova and then to Morocco. He was accused of cultivating the philosophy of the ancients at the expense of the true faith. Al-Mansur published an edict to the effect that God had decreed hellfire for those who thought that truth could be found by the unaided reason. All the books that could be found on logic and metaphysics were given to the flames. Footnote. It is said that Averroes was taken back into favor shortly before his death. End of footnote. Shortly after this time, the Moorish territory in Spain was greatly diminished by Christian conquests. Muslim philosophy in Spain ended with Averroes, and in the rest of the Mohammedan world, a rigid orthodoxy put an end to speculation. Ubervig, rather amusingly, undertakes to defend Averroes against the charge of unorthodoxy, a matter, one would say, for Muslims to decide. Ubervig points out that, according to the mystics, every text of the Quran had 7 or 70 or 700 layers of interpretation, the literal meaning being only for the ignorant vulgar. It would seem to follow that a philosopher's teaching could not possibly conflict with the Quran, for among 700 interpretations, there would surely be at least one that would fit what the philosopher had to say. In the Mohammedan world, however, the ignorant seemed to have objected to all learning that went beyond a knowledge of the Holy Book. It was dangerous, even if no specific heresy could be demonstrated. The view of the mystics, that the populace should take the Quran literally, but wise people need not do so, was hardly likely to win wide popular acceptance. Averroes was concerned to improve the Arabic interpretation of Aristotle, which had been unduly influenced by Neoplatonism. He gave to Aristotle the sort of reverence that is given to the founder of a religion, much more than was given even by Avicenna. He holds that the existence of God can be proved by reason independently of revelation, a view also held by Thomas Aquinas. As regards immortality, he seems to have adhered closely to Aristotle, maintaining that the soul is not immortal, but intellect, nous, is. This, however, does not secure personal immortality, since intellect is one and the same when manifested in different persons. This view, naturally, was combated by Christian philosophers. Averroes, like most of the later Mohammedan philosophers, though a believer, was not rigidly orthodox. There was a sect of completely orthodox theologians who objected to all philosophy as deleterious to the faith. One of these, named Al-Ghazal, wrote a book called Destruction of the Philosophers, pointing out that since all necessary truth is in the Quran, there is no need of speculation independent of revelation. Averroes replied by a book called Destruction of the Destruction. The religious dogmas that Al-Ghazal specially upheld against the philosophers were the creation of the world in time out of nothing, the reality of the divine attributes, and the resurrection of the body. Averroes regards religion as containing philosophic truth in allegorical form. This applies in particular to creation, which he in his philosophic capacity interprets in an Aristotelian fashion. Averroes is more important in Christian than in Mohammedan philosophy. In the latter, he was a dead end. In the former, a beginning. He was translated into Latin early in the 13th century by Michael Scott. As his works belong to the latter half of the 12th century, this is surprising. His influence in Europe was very great, not only on the scholastics, but also on a large body of unprofessional free thinkers who denied immortality and were called Averroists. Among professional philosophers, his admirers were at first especially among the Franciscans and at the University of Paris. But this is a topic which will be dealt with in a later chapter. Arabic philosophy is not important as original thought. Men like Avicenna and Averroes are essentially commentators. Speaking generally, the views of the more scientific philosophers come from Aristotle and the Neoplatonists in logic and metaphysics, from Galen in medicine, from Greek and Indian sources in mathematics and astronomy, and among mystics, religious philosophy has also an admixture of old Persian beliefs. Writers in Arabic show some originality in mathematics and in chemistry, in the latter case as an incidental result of alchemical researches. Mohammedan civilization in its great days was admirable in the arts and in many technical ways, but it showed no capacity for independent speculation in theoretical matters. Its importance, which must not be underrated, is as a transmitter. Between ancient and modern European civilization, the Dark Ages intervened. The Mohammedans and the Byzantines, while lacking the intellectual energy required for innovation, preserved the apparatus of civilization, education, books, and learned leisure. Both stimulated the West when it emerged from barbarism, the Mohammedans chiefly in the 13th century, the Byzantines chiefly in the 15th. In each case, the stimulus produced new thought better than any produced by the transmitters. In the one case, scholasticism, in the other, the Renaissance, which, however, had other causes also. Between the Spanish Moors and the Christians, the Jews formed a useful link. There were many Jews in Spain who remained when the country was reconquered by the Christians. Since they knew Arabic and perforce acquired the language of the Christians, they were able to supply translations. Another means of transfusion arose through Mohammedan persecution of Aristotelians in the 13th century, which led Moorish philosophers to take refuge with Jews, especially in Provence. The Spanish Jews produced one philosopher of importance, Maimonides. He was born in Cordova in 1135, but went to Cairo at the age of 30 and stayed there for the rest of his life. He wrote in Arabic, but was immediately translated into Hebrew. A few decades after his death, he was translated into Latin, probably at the request of the Emperor Frederick II. He wrote a book called Guide to Wanderers, addressed to philosophers who have lost their faith. Its purpose is to reconcile Aristotle with Jewish theology. Aristotle is the authority on the sublunary world, revelation on the heavenly. But philosophy and revelation come together in the knowledge of God. The pursuit of truth is a religious duty. Astrology is rejected. The Pentateuch is not always to be taken literally. When the literal sense conflicts with reason, we must seek an allegorical interpretation. As against Aristotle, he maintains that God created not only form, but matter out of nothing. He gives a summary of the Timaeus, which he knew in Arabic, preferring it on some points to Aristotle. The essence of God is unknowable, being above all predicated perfections. The Jews considered him heretical, and went so far as to invoke the Christian ecclesiastical authorities against him. Some think that he influenced Spinoza, but this is very questionable. Chapter 11, the 12th century. Four aspects of the 12th century are specially interesting to us. 1, the continued conflict of empire and papacy. 2, the rise of the Lombard cities. 3, the Crusades. And 4, the growth of scholasticism. All these four continued into the following century. The Crusades gradually came to an inglorious end, but as regards the other three movements, the 13th century marks the culmination of what, in the 12th, is in a transitional stage. In the 13th century, the Pope definitively triumphed over the Emperor. The Lombard cities acquired secure independence, and scholasticism reached its highest point. All this, however, was an outcome of what the 12th century had prepared. Not only the first of these four movements, but the other three also, are intimately bound up with the increase of papal and ecclesiastical power. The Pope was in alliance with the Lombard cities against the Emperor. Pope Urban II inaugurated the First Crusade, and subsequent popes were the main promoters of the later ones. The scholastic philosophers were all clerics, and church councils took care to keep them within the bounds of orthodoxy, or discipline them if they strayed. Undoubtedly, their sense of the political triumph of the church, in which they felt themselves participants, stimulated their intellectual initiative. One of the curious things about the Middle Ages is that they were original and creative without knowing it. All parties justified their policies by antiquarian and archaistic arguments. The emperor appealed in Germany to the feudal principles of the time of Charlemagne, in Italy to Roman law and the power of ancient emperors. The Lombard cities went still further back to the institutions of Republican Rome. The Papal Party based its claims partly on the forged donation of Constantine, partly on the relations of Saul and Samuel, as told in the Old Testament. The scholastics appealed either to the scriptures or at first to Plato and then to Aristotle. When they were original, they tried to conceal the fact. The Crusades were an endeavor to restore the state of affairs that had existed before the rise of Islam. We must not be deceived by this literary archaism. Only in the case of the emperor did it correspond with the facts. Feudalism was in decay, especially in Italy. The Roman Empire was a mere memory. Accordingly, the emperor was defeated. The cities of North Italy, while in their later development they showed much similarity to the cities of ancient Greece, repeated the pattern not from imitation, but from analogy of circumstances, that of small, rich, highly civilized republican commercial communities surrounded by monarchies at a lower level of culture. The scholastics, however they might revere Aristotle, showed more originality than any of the Arabs, more indeed than anyone since Plotinus, or at any rate since Augustine. In politics as in thought, there was the same disguised originality. Conflict of empire and papacy. From the time of Gregory VII to the middle of the 13th century, European history centers round the struggle for power between the church and the lay monarchs, primarily the emperor, but also on occasion the kings of France and England. Gregory's pontificate had ended in apparent disaster, but his policies were resumed, though with more moderation, by Urban II, 1088 to 1099, who repeated the decrees against lay investiture and desired episcopal elections to be made freely by clergy and people. The share of the people was, no doubt, to be purely formal. In practice, however, he did not quarrel with lay appointments if they were good. At first, Urban was safe only in Norman territory. But in 1093, Henry IV's son Conrad rebelled against his father and, in alliance with the Pope, conquered North Italy, where the Lombard League, an alliance of cities with Milan at its head, favored the Pope. In 1094, Urban made a triumphal procession through North Italy and France. He triumphed over Philip, King of France, who desired a divorce and was therefore excommunicated by the Pope, and then submitted. At the Council of Clermont in 1095, Urban proclaimed the First Crusade, which produced a wave of religious enthusiasm leading to increase of papal power, also to atrocious pogroms of Jews. The last year of Urban's life he spent in safety in Rome, where popes were seldom safe. The next pope, Pascal II, like Urban, came from Cluny. He continued the struggle on investitures and was successful in France and England. But after the death of Henry IV in 1106, the next emperor, Henry V, got the better of the Pope, who was an unworldly man and allowed his saintliness to outweigh his political sense. The Pope proposed that the emperor should renounce investitures, but in return, bishops and abbots should renounce temporal possessions. The emperor professed to agree, but when the suggested compromise was made public, the ecclesiastics rebelled furiously against the Pope. The emperor, who was in Rome, took the opportunity to seize the Pope, who yielded to threats, gave way on investitures, and crowned Henry V. 11 years later, however, by the Concordat of Worms in 1122, Pope Calixtus II compelled Henry V to give way on investitures and to surrender control over episcopal elections in Burgundy and Italy. So far, the net result of the struggle was that the Pope, who had been subject to Henry III, had become the equal of the emperor. At the same time, he had become more completely sovereign in the church, which he governed by means of legates. This increase of papal power had diminished the relative importance of bishops. Papal elections were now free from lay control, and ecclesiastics generally were more virtuous than they had been before the reform movement. Rise of the Lombard cities. The next stage was connected with the Emperor Frederick Barbarossa, 1152 to 1190, an able and energetic man who would have succeeded in any enterprise in which success was possible. He was a man of education, who read Latin with pleasure, though he spoke it with difficulty. His classical learning was considerable, and he was an admirer of Roman law. He thought of himself as the heir of the Roman emperors and hoped to acquire their power. But as a German, he was unpopular in Italy. The Lombard cities, while willing to acknowledge his formal overlordship, objected when he interfered in their affairs, except those which feared Milan, against which city some of them invoked his protection. The Pateran movement in Milan continued and was associated with a more or less democratic tendency. Most, but by no means all, of the North Italian cities sympathized with Milan and made common cause against the emperor. Hadrian IV, a vigorous Englishman who had been a missionary in Norway, became pope 2 years after the accession of Barbarossa, and was at first on good terms with him. They were reconciled by a common enmity. The city of Rome claimed independence from both alike, and as a help in the struggle had invited a saintly heretic, Arnold of Brescia. Footnote. He was said to be a pupil of Abelard, but this is doubtful. End of footnote. His heresy was very grave. He maintained that clerks who have estates, bishops who hold fiefs, monks who possess property cannot be saved. He held this view because he thought that the clergy ought to devote themselves entirely to spiritual matters. No one questioned his sincere austerity, although he was accounted wicked on account of his heresy. St. Bernard, who vehemently opposed him, said, "He neither eats nor drinks, but only, like the devil, hungers and thirsts for the blood of souls." Hadrian's predecessor in the papacy had written to Barbarossa to complain that Arnold supported the popular faction, which wished to elect 100 senators and 2 consuls, and to have an emperor of their own. Frederick, who was setting out for Italy, was naturally scandalized. The Roman demand for communal liberty, which was encouraged by Arnold, led to a riot in which a cardinal was killed. The newly elected Pope Hadrian thereupon placed Rome under an interdict. It was Holy Week, and superstition got the better of the Romans. They submitted and promised to banish Arnold. He hid, but was captured by the emperor's troops. He was burnt, and his ashes were thrown into the Tiber for fear of their being preserved as holy relics. After a delay caused by Frederick's unwillingness to hold the Pope's bridle and stirrup while he dismounted, the Pope crowned the Emperor in 1155 amid the resistance of the populace, which was quelled with great slaughter. The honest man being disposed of, the practical politicians were free to resume their quarrel. The Pope, having made peace with the Normans, ventured in 1157 to break with the Emperor. For 20 years there was almost continuous war between the Emperor on the one side and the Pope with the Lombard cities on the other. The Normans mostly supported the Pope. The bulk of the fighting against the Emperor was done by the Lombard League, which spoke of liberty and was inspired by intense popular feeling. The Emperor besieged various cities, and in 1162 even captured Milan, which he razed to the ground, compelling its citizens to live elsewhere. But 5 years later, the League rebuilt Milan, and the former inhabitants returned. In this same year, the Emperor, duly provided with an antipope, marched on Rome with a great army. Footnote. There was an antipope throughout most of this time. At the death of Hadrian IV, the two claimants, Alexander III and Victor IV, had a tug of war for the papal mantle. Victor IV, who was the antipope, having failed to snatch the mantle, obtained from his partisans a substitute, which he had had prepared, but in his haste he put it on inside out. End of footnote. The Pope fled, and his cause seemed desperate, but pestilence destroyed Frederick's army, and he returned to Germany a solitary fugitive. Although not only Sicily, but the Greek emperor now sided with the Lombard League, Barbarossa made another attempt, ending in his defeat at the Battle of Legnano in 1176. After this, he was compelled to make peace, leaving to the cities all the substance of liberty. In the conflict between empire and papacy, however, the terms of peace gave neither party complete victory. Barbarossa's end was seemly. In 1189 he went on the Third Crusade, and in the following year he died. The rise of free cities is what proved of most ultimate importance in this long strife. The power of the emperor was associated with the decaying feudal system. The power of the pope, though still growing, was largely dependent upon the world's need of him as an antagonist to the emperor, and therefore decayed when the empire ceased to be a menace. But the power of the cities was new, a result of economic progress, and a source of new political forms. Although this does not appear in the 12th century, the Italian cities, before long, developed a non-clerical culture which reached the very highest levels in literature, in art, and in science. All this was rendered possible by their successful resistance to Barbarossa. All the great cities of northern Italy lived by trade, and in the 12th century, the more settled conditions made traders more prosperous than before. The maritime cities, Venice, Genoa, and Pisa, never had to fight for their liberty, and were therefore less hostile to the emperor than the cities at the foot of the Alps, which were important to him as the gateways to Italy. It is for this reason that Milan is the most interesting and important of Italian cities at this time. Until the time of Henry III, the Milanese had usually been content to follow their archbishop. But the Patarin movement, mentioned in an earlier chapter, changed this. The archbishop sided with the nobility, while a powerful popular movement opposed him and them. Some beginnings of democracy resulted, and a constitution arose under which the rulers of the city were elected by the citizens. In various northern cities, but especially in Bologna, there was a learned class of lay lawyers, well versed in Roman law. Moreover, the rich laity, from the 12th century onwards, were much better educated than the feudal nobility north of the Alps. Although they sided with the Pope against the Emperor, the rich commercial cities were not ecclesiastical in their outlook. In the 12th and 13th centuries, many of them adopted heresies of a Puritan sort, like the merchants of England and Holland after the Reformation. Later, they tended to be free thinkers, paying lip service to the Church, but destitute of all real piety. Dante is the last of the old type, Boccaccio the first of the new. The Crusades. The Crusades need not concern us as wars, but they have a certain importance in relation to culture. It was natural for the papacy to take the lead in the initiating of a crusade, since the object was, at least ostensibly, religious. Thus, the power of the popes was increased by the war propaganda and by the religious zeal that was excited. Another important effect was the massacre of large numbers of Jews. Those who were not massacred were often despoiled of their property and forcibly baptized. There were large-scale murders of Jews in Germany at the time of the First Crusade and in England at the time of the Third Crusade on the accession of Richard Coeur de Lion. York, where the first Christian emperor had begun his reign, was, aptly enough, the scene of one of the most appalling mass atrocities against Jews. The Jews, before the Crusades, had almost a monopoly of the trade in Eastern goods throughout Europe. After the Crusades, as a result of the persecution of Jews, this trade was largely in Christian hands. Another and very different effect of the Crusades was to stimulate literary intercourse with Constantinople. During the 12th and early 13th centuries, many translations from Greek into Latin were made as a result of this intercourse. There had always been much trade with Constantinople, especially by Venetians, but Italian traders did not trouble themselves with Greek classics any more than English or American traders in Shanghai troubled themselves with the classics of China. European knowledge of Chinese classics was derived mainly from missionaries. The growth of Scholasticism. Scholasticism, in its narrower sense, begins early in the 12th century. As a philosophic school, it has certain definite characteristics. First, it is confined within the limits of what appears to the writer to be orthodoxy. If his views are condemned by a council, he is usually willing to retract. This is not to be attributed entirely to cowardice. It is analogous to the submission of a judge to the decision of a court of appeal. Second, within the limits of orthodoxy, Aristotle, who gradually became more fully known during the 12th and 13th centuries, is increasingly accepted as the supreme authority. Plato no longer holds the first place. Third, there is a great belief in dialectic and in syllogistic reasoning. The general temper of the scholastics is minute and disputatious rather than mystical. Fourth, the question of universals is brought to the fore by the discovery that Aristotle and Plato do not agree about it. It would be a mistake to suppose, however, that universals are the main concern of the philosophers of this period. The 12th century, in this as in other matters, prepares the way for the 13th, to which the greatest names belong. The earlier men have, however, the interest of pioneers. There is a new intellectual confidence, and in spite of the respect for Aristotle, a free and vigorous exercise of reason wherever dogma has not made speculation too dangerous. The defects of the scholastic method are those that inevitably result from laying stress on dialectic. These defects are indifference to facts and science, belief in reasoning in matters which only observation can decide, and an undue emphasis on verbal distinctions and subtleties. These defects we had occasion to mention in a connection with Plato, but in the scholastics they exist in a much more extreme form. The first philosopher who can be regarded as strictly a scholastic is Roslin. Not very much is known about him. He was born at Compiègne about 1050 and taught at Loches in Brittany, where Abélard was his pupil. He was accused of heresy at a council at Rheims in 1092, and recanted for fear of being stoned to death by ecclesiastics with a taste for lynching. He fled to England, but there he was rash enough to attack St. Anselm. This time he fled to Rome, where he was reconciled to the church. He disappears from history about 1120. The date of his death is purely conjectural. Nothing remains of Roslin's writings except a letter to Abélard on the Trinity. In this letter, he belittles Abélard and makes merry over his castration. Ubervig, who seldom displays emotion, is led to observe that he can't have been a very nice man. Apart from this letter, Roslin's views are chiefly known through the controversial writings of Anselm and Abélard. According to Anselm, he said that universals are mere flatus vocis, breath of the voice. If this is to be taken literally, it means that a universal is a physical occurrence, that, namely, which takes place when we pronounce a word. It is hardly to be supposed, however, that Roslin maintained anything so foolish. Anselm says that, according to Roslin, man is not a unity, but only a common name. This view, Anselm, like a good Platonist, attributes to Roslin's only conceding reality to what is sensible. He seems to have held, generally, that a whole which has parts has no reality of its own, but is a mere word. The reality is in the parts. This view should have led him, and perhaps did lead him, to an extreme atomism. In any case, it led him into trouble about the Trinity. He considered that the three persons are three distinct substances, and that only usage stands in the way of our saying that there are three gods. The alternative, which he does not accept, is, according to him, to say that not only the Son, but the Father and the Holy Ghost were incarnate. All this speculation, in so far as it was heretical, he recanted at Rheims in 1092. It is impossible to know exactly what he thought about universals, but at any rate it is plain that he was some sort of nominalist. His pupil Abélard, A-B-E-L-A-R-D, or Abélard, A-B-A-I-L-A-R-D, was much abler and much more distinguished. He was born near Nantes in 1079, was a pupil of William of Champeaux, a realist in Paris, and then a teacher in the Paris Cathedral School, where he combated William's views and compelled him to modify them. After a period devoted to the study of theology under Anselm of Laon, not the archbishop, he returned to Paris in 1113 and acquired extraordinary popularity as a teacher. It was at this time that he became the lover of Héloïse, niece of Canon Foubert. The canon had him castrated, and he and Héloïse had to retire from the world, he into a monastery at Saint-Denis, she into a nunnery at Argenteuil. Their famous correspondence is said, by a learned German named Schmeidler, to have been entirely composed by Abélard as a literary fiction. I am not competent to judge as to the correctness of this theory, but nothing in Abélard's character makes it impossible. He was always vain, disputatious, and contemptuous. After his misfortune, he was also angry and humiliated. Héloïse's letters are much more devoted than his, and one can imagine him composing them as a balm to his wounded pride. Even in his retirement, he still had great success as a teacher. The young liked his cleverness, his dialectical skill, and his irreverence towards their other teachers. Older men felt the correlative dislike of him, and in 1121 he was condemned at Soissons for an unorthodox book on the Trinity. Having made due submission, he became abbot of St. Gildas in Brittany, where he found the monks savage boors. After four miserable years in his exile, he returned to comparative civilization. His further history is obscure, except that he continued to teach with great success, according to the testimony of John of Salisbury. In 1141, at the instance of St. Bernard, he was again condemned, this time at Sens. He retired to Cluny and died the next year. Abélard's most famous book, composed in 1121-22, is Sic et Non, Yes and No. Here he gives dialectical arguments for and against a great variety of theses, often without attempting to arrive at a conclusion. Clearly, he likes the disputation itself, and considers it useful as sharpening the wits. The book had a considerable effect in waking people from their dogmatic slumbers. Abélard's view that, apart from Scripture, dialectic is the sole road to truth, while no empiricist can accept it, had at the time a valuable effect as a solvent of prejudices and an encouragement to the fearless use of the intellect. Nothing outside the Scriptures, he said, is infallible. Even apostles and fathers may err. His valuation of logic was, from a modern point of view, excessive. He considered it preeminently the Christian science, and made play with its derivation from logos. In the beginning was the logos, says St. John's Gospel, and this, he thought, proves the dignity of logic. His chief importance is in logic and theory of knowledge. His philosophy is a critical analysis, largely linguistic. As for universals, that is, what can be predicated of many different things, he holds that we do not predicate a thing, but a word. In this sense, he is a nominalist. But as against Rosler, he points out that a flatus vocis is a thing. It is not the word as a physical occurrence that we predicate, but the word as meaning. Here he appeals to Aristotle. Things, he says, resemble each other, and these resemblances give rise to universals. But the point of resemblance between two similar things is not itself a thing. This is the mistake of realism. He says some things that are even more hostile to realism, for example, that general concepts are not based in the nature of things, but are confused images of many things. Nevertheless, he does not wholly refuse a place to Platonic ideas. They exist in the divine mind as patterns for creation. They are, in fact, God's concepts. All this, whether right or wrong, is certainly very able. The most modern discussions of the problem of universals have not got much further. St. Bernard, whose saintliness did not suffice to make him intelligent, failed to understand Abélard and brought unjust accusations against him. Footnote. The greatness of St. Bernard lay not in the qualities of his intellect, but of his character. Encyclopaedia Britannica. End of footnote. He asserted that Abélard treats the Trinity like an Arian, grace like a Pelagian, and the person of Christ like an Nestorian, that he proves himself a heathen in sweating to prove Plato a Christian, and further, that he destroys the merit of the Christian faith by maintaining that God can be completely understood by human reason. In fact, Abélard never maintained this last and always left a large province to faith, although, like St. Anselm, he thought that the Trinity could be rationally demonstrated without the help of revelation. It is true that at one time he identified the Holy Ghost with the Platonic soul of the world, but he abandoned this view as soon as its heretical character was pointed out to him. Probably it was more his combativeness than his doctrines that caused him to be accused of heresy, for his habit of criticizing pundits made him violently unpopular with all influential persons. Most of the learned men of the time were less devoted to dialectic than Abélard was. There was, especially in the school of Chartres, a humanistic movement which admired antiquity and followed Plato and Boethius. There was a renewed interest in mathematics. Adelard of Bath went to Spain early in the 12th century and, in consequence, translated Euclid. As opposed to the dry scholastic method, there was a strong mystical movement, of which St. Bernard was the leader. His father was a knight who died in the First Crusade. He himself was a Cistercian monk, and in 1115 became abbot of the newly founded Abbey of Clairvaux. He was very influential in ecclesiastical politics, turning the scales against antipopes, combating heresy in northern Italy and southern France, bringing the weight of orthodoxy to bear on adventurous philosophers, and preaching the Second Crusade. In attacking philosophers, he was usually successful, but after the collapse of his crusade, he failed to secure the conviction of Gilbert de la Porree, who agreed with Boethius more than seemed right to the saintly heresy hunter. Although a politician and a bigot, he was a man of genuinely religious temperament, and his Latin hymns have great beauty. Footnote. Medieval Latin hymns, rhymed and accentual, give expression, sometimes sublime, sometimes gentle and pathetic, to the best side of the religious feeling of the times. End of footnote. Among those influenced by him, mysticism became increasingly dominant, till it passed into something like heresy in Joachim of Flora, died 1202. The influence of this man, however, belongs to a later time.
And pressure in his life.
Followers sought religious truth, not in reasoning, but in subjective experience and contemplation. Abélard and Bernard are perhaps equally one-sided. Bernard, as a religious mystic, deployed the absorption of the papacy in worldly concerns and disliked the temporal power. Although he preached the crusade, he did not seem to understand that a war requires organization and cannot be conducted by religious enthusiasm alone. He complains that the law of Justinian, not the law of the Lord, absorbs men's attention. He is shocked when the Pope defends his domain by military force. The function of the Pope is spiritual, and he should not attempt actual government. This point of view, however, is combined with unbounded reverence for the Pope, whom he calls Prince of Bishops, Heir of the Apostles, of the Primacy of Abel, the Governance of Noah, the Patriarchate of Abraham, the Order of Melchizedek, the Dignity of Aaron, the Authority of Moses, in Judgeship Samuel, in Power Peter, in Unction Christ. The net result of St. Bernard's activities was, of course, a great increase of the power of the Pope in secular affairs. John of Salisbury, though not an important thinker, is valuable for our knowledge of his times, of which he wrote a gossipy account. He was secretary to three archbishops of Canterbury, one of whom was Becket. He was a friend of Hadrian IV, At the end of his life, he was Bishop of Chartres, where he died in 1180. In matters outside the faith, he was a man of sceptical temper. He called himself an academic, in the sense in which St. Augustine uses this term. His respect for kings was limited. An illiterate king is a crowned ass. He revered St. Bernard, but was well aware that his attempt to reconcile Plato and Aristotle must be a failure. He admired Abelard, but laughed at his theory of universals, and at Rousselin's equally. He thought logic a good introduction to learning, but in itself bloodless and sterile. Aristotle, he says, can be improved on, even in logic. Respect for ancient authors should not hamper the critical exercise of reason. Plato is still to him the prince of all philosophers. He knows personally most of the learned men of his time and takes a friendly part in scholastic debates. On revisiting one school of philosophy after 30 years, he smiles to find them still discussing the same problems. The atmosphere of the society that he frequents is very like that of Oxford Common Rooms 30 years ago. Towards the end of his life, the cathedral schools gave place to universities, and universities, at least in England, have had a remarkable continuity from that day to this. During the 12th century, translators gradually increased the number of Greek books available to Western students. There were three main sources of such translations: Constantinople, Palermo, and Toledo. Of these, Toledo was the most important, but the translations coming from there were often from the Arabic, not direct from the Greek. In the second quarter of the 12th century, Archbishop Raymond of Toledo instituted a college of translators whose work was very fruitful. In 1128, James of Venice translated Aristotle's Analytics, Topics, and Sophistici Elenchi. The posterior Analytics were found difficult by Western philosophers. Henry Aristippus of Catania, died 1162, translated the Phaedo and Meno, but his translations had no immediate effect. Partial as was the knowledge of Greek philosophy in the 12th century, learned men were aware that much of it remained to be discovered by the West, and a certain eagerness arose to acquire a fuller knowledge of antiquity. The yoke of orthodoxy was not so severe as is sometimes supposed. A man could always write his book and then, if necessary, withdraw its heretical portions after full public discussion. Most of the philosophers of the time were French, and France was important to the Church as a make-weight against the Empire. Whatever theological heresies might occur among them, learned clerics were almost all politically orthodox. This made the peculiar wickedness of Arnold of Brescia, who was an exception to the rule. The whole of early scholasticism may be viewed politically as an offshoot of the Church's struggle for power. Chapter 12. The 13th Century. In the 13th century, the Middle Ages reached a culmination. The synthesis, which had been gradually built up since the fall of Rome, became as complete as it was capable of being. The 14th century brought a dissolution of institutions and philosophies. The 15th brought the beginning of those that we still regard as modern. The great men of the 13th century were very great: Innocent III, St. Francis, Frederick II, and Thomas Aquinas are, in their different ways, supreme representatives of their respective types. There were also great achievements not so definitely associated with great names: the Gothic cathedrals of France, the romantic literature of Charlemagne, Arthur, and the Nibelungen, the beginnings of constitutional government in Magna Carta and the House of Commons. The matter that concerns us most directly is the scholastic philosophy, especially as set forth by Aquinas. But I shall leave this for the next chapter, and attempt, first, to give an outline of the events that did most to form the mental atmosphere of the age. The central figure at the beginning of the century is Pope Innocent III, 1198 to 1216, a shrewd politician, a man of infinite vigour, a firm believer in the most extreme claims of the papacy, but not endowed with Christian humility. At his consecration, he preached from the text, "See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms, to pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant." He called himself King of Kings, Lord of Lords, a priest for ever and ever, according to the order of Melchizedek. In enforcing this view of himself, he took advantage of every favorable circumstance. In Sicily, which had been conquered by the Emperor Henry VI, died 1197, who had married Constance, heiress of the Norman kings, the new king was Frederick, only 3 years old at the time of Innocent's accession. The kingdom was turbulent, and Constance needed the Pope's help. She made him guardian of the infant Frederick, and secured his recognition of her son's rights in Sicily by acknowledging papal superiority. Portugal and Aragon made similar acknowledgments. In England, King John, after vehement resistance, was compelled to yield his kingdom to Innocent and receive it back as a papal fief. To some degree, the Venetians got the better of him in the matter of the Fourth Crusade. The soldiers of the cross were to embark at Venice, but there were difficulties in procuring enough ships. No one had enough except the Venetians, and they maintained, for purely commercial reasons, that it would be much better to conquer Constantinople than Jerusalem. In any case, it would be a useful stepping stone, and the Eastern Empire had never been very friendly to crusaders. It was found necessary to give way to Venice. Constantinople was captured, and a Latin emperor established. At first, Innocent was annoyed, but he reflected that it might now be possible to reunite the Eastern and Western churches. This hope proved vain. Except in this instance, I do not know of anybody who ever in any degree got the better of Innocent III. He ordered the great crusade against the Albigenses, which rooted out heresy, happiness, prosperity, and culture from southern France. He deposed Raymond, Count of Toulouse, for lukewarmness about the crusade, and secured most of the region of the Albigenses for its leader, Simon de Montfort, father of the father of Parliament. He quarrelled with the Emperor Otto, and called upon the Germans to depose him. They did so, and at his suggestion elected Frederick II, now just of age, in his stead. But for his support of Frederick, he exacted a terrific price in promises, which, however, Frederick was determined to break as soon as possible. Innocent III was the first great pope, in whom there was no element of sanctity. The reform of the church made the hierarchy feel secure as to its moral prestige, and therefore convinced that it need no longer trouble to be holy. The power motive, from his time on, more and more exclusively dominated the papacy and produced opposition from some religious men even in his day. He codified the canon law so as to increase the power of the curia. Walter von Vogelweide called this code the blackest book that hell ever gave. Although the papacy still had resounding victories to win, the manner of its subsequent decline might already have been foreseen. Frederick II, who had been the ward of Innocent III, went to Germany in 1212, and by the Pope's help was elected to replace Otto. Innocent did not live to see what a formidable antagonist he had raised up against the papacy. Frederick, one of the most remarkable rulers known to history, had passed his childhood and youth in difficult and adverse circumstances. His father, Henry VI, son of Barbarossa, had defeated the Normans of Sicily and married Constance, heiress to the kingdom. He established a German garrison, which was hated by the Sicilians. But he died in 1197 when Frederick was 3 years old. Constance thereupon turned against the Germans and tried to govern without them by the help of the Pope. The Germans were resentful, and Otto tried to conquer Sicily. This was the cause of his quarrel with the Pope. Palermo, where Frederick passed his childhood, was subject to other troubles. There were Muslim revolts. The Pisans and Genoese fought each other, and everyone else, for possession of the island. The important people in Sicily were constantly changing sides, according as one party or the other offered the higher price for treachery. Culturally, however, Sicily had great advantages. Muslim, Byzantine, Italian, and German civilization met and mingled there as nowhere else. Greek and Arabic were still living languages in Sicily. Frederick learnt to speak six languages fluently, and in all six he was witty. He was at home in Arabian philosophy and had friendly relations with Mohammedans, which scandalized pious Christians. He was a Hohenstaufen, and in Germany could count as a German. But in culture and sentiment he was Italian, with a tincture of Byzantine and Arab. His contemporaries gazed upon him with astonishment, gradually turning into horror. They called him Wonder of the World and Marvelous Innovator. While still alive, he was the subject of myths. He was said to be the author of a book, De Tribus Impostoribus, The three impostors were Moses, Christ, and Mohammed. This book, which never existed, was attributed successively to many enemies of the Church, the last of whom was Spinoza. The words Guelph and Ghibelline began to be used at the time of Frederick's contest with the Emperor Otto. They are corruptions of Welf and Weibligen, the family names of the two contestants. Otto's nephew was an ancestor of the British royal family. Innocent III died in 1216. Otto, whom Frederick had defeated, died in 1218. The new pope, Honorius III, was at first on good terms with Frederick, but difficulties soon arose. First, Frederick refused to go on crusade. Then he had trouble with the Lombard cities, which in 1226 contracted an offensive and defensive alliance for 25 years. They hated the Germans. One of their poets wrote fiery verses against them. "Love not the folk of Germany, far, far from you be these mad dogs." This seems to have expressed the general feeling in Lombardy. Frederick wanted to remain in Italy to deal with the cities, but in 1227 Honorius died and was succeeded by Gregory IX, a fiery ascetic who loved St. Francis and was beloved by him. He canonized St. Francis 2 years after his death. Gregory thought nothing else so important as the crusade and excommunicated Frederick for not undertaking it. Frederick, who had married the daughter and heiress of the King of Jerusalem, was willing enough to go when he could and called himself King of Jerusalem. In 1228, while still excommunicate, he went. This made Gregory even more angry than his previously not going, for how could the crusading host be led by a man whom the Pope had banned? Arrived in Palestine, Frederick made friends with the Mohammedans, explained to them that the Christians attached importance to Jerusalem, although it was of little strategic value, and succeeded in inducing them peaceably to restore the city to him. This made the Pope still more furious. One should fight the infidel, not negotiate with him. However, Frederick was duly crowned in Jerusalem, and no one could deny that he had been successful. Peace between Pope and Emperor was restored in 1230. During the few years of peace that followed, the Emperor devoted himself to the affairs of the Kingdom of Sicily.